You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. It's Monday, May 31st, 2010, and today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Nancy Means Wright, author of the new novel Midnight Fires, a mystery with Mary Wollstonecraft, published by Perseverance Press in April. Nancy Means Wright is the author of many books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, including an adult mystery series that featured Vermont dairy farmer Ruth Wilmart. The Pea Soup Poisonings, based on her children's childhood adventures, won an Agatha Award for 2006 Best Children's YA Novel. Nancy Means Wright's short stories and poems have appeared in numerous anthologies and dozens of magazines, including American Literary Review, 17, Green Mountain Review, Carolina Quarterly, and Red Book. A former Breadloaf Scholar, grant winner from the Society of Children's Book Writers, a current scholar for the Vermont Humanities Council, play director, and longtime teacher, she lives on a dirt road in Cornwall with her husband and two Maine coon cats. Midnight Fires is her first work of historical fiction. Publishers Weekly called it captivating and said Wright deftly illuminates 18th century class tensions. When I spoke to Nancy Means Wright earlier this month, I asked her how she discovered Mary Wollstonecraft and what inspired her to write about her.
Actually, I discovered her sort of through the back door, because I was in secondary school and junior, and I fell in love with Percy Bysshe Shelley, who was to become her son-in-law eventually when he married her daughter, Mary. And you know Mary Shelley, who
right.
wrote Frankenstein, of course.
Yes.
And at the time, I had just heard that his mother-in-law was Mary Wollstonecraft, but I just didn't know too much about her. And I think at that time, my teacher, who was kind of stuffy old lady, wonderful teacher, but you know, very conventional, I think because Mary was considered sort of a bad girl for years, right up until the 50s, when a first biography came out on her, that she didn't tell us much about or ask us to look up Mary Wollstonecraft. So it wasn't until the 60s, after I was married and we were teaching in this boys' school, Proctor Academy, in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. where the headmaster, who was also a little bit very conservative, would not let me teach English because he said it was a man's subject. I mean, just only a male could teach English. So I eventually ended up teaching French. But anyway, it was a school that was under the aegis of the Unitarian Church. And not that the students had to be Unitarians or whatever, but it just happened to be. And I joined this Unitarian women's group, we had a book discussion, sort of little group, and one name that came up was Mary Wollstonecraft. And I had also, out of a library, picked up A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and that was her groundbreaking book. In A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which published in 1792, it was just incredible. She advocated, well, breastfeeding, for one. I mean, that's just a minor thing, except that in those days,
but it wasn't at
aristocratic
the time.
Women did not do that. They just handed all their children over to, you know, the wet nurses or whatever. And when they were 5 years old, they brought them back. And she advocated divorce, and divorce was something you had. It took an act of God to be able to get a divorce in the 18th century. She advocated, among all things, coeducation. In other words, girls and boys in the same schools, which people thought, oh, what a blow to female modesty, and learning, and girls learning the same, studying the same subjects as boys, you know, chemistry and Latin and Greek and things like that. And girls, of course, weren't supposed to have, you know, these sort of smaller brains. Or what are they going to use it for anyway? They're just going to go and get married. You know, it's just absurd. Oh, in fact, she also called, particularly she called something like a arranged marriage a kind of legal prostitution. So she really upset a lot of people in the 18th century, a lot of women as well as men. Although there were many women, of course, were saying, hurrah, hurrah, it's about time something like this came back. But she was called a hyena in petticoats. It was horrifying. They called her all kinds of names. But she just pushed her way through it. She was just an incredibly feisty woman. She lived in a fairly respectable middle class family, but her father had lost all of her. Each time he kept changing jobs, he would lose more money, and the more money he lost, the more frustrated he got, and the more frustrated he got, the more he drank, and the more he abused her mother. There were seven children altogether. Unfortunately, Mary remembers lying on the landing of her mother's room when her father would come stomping, dead drunk, up the stairs, and trying to keep him out of there. So she was just sort of kept this whole family of seven together. But sadly, the mother preferred the older brother to Mary, and Mary was just left to sort of babysit all the younger ones, the five younger siblings, which she didn't. I mean, until the end of her short life, she gave them money and helped them get jobs, and they always looked to her for whatever, refuge in right. some way. So she finally left home when she was 19 and went to work for an elderly woman. Of course, in those days, there weren't many jobs that a somewhat respectable girl could do. And one of them was teaching. Another one was just, helping women who debilitated women or whatever. She ultimately opened a school with her very close friend, Fanny Blood, her name was. Mary was really self-schooled, because in those days, boys just had all of the schooling. Boys got sent away to school, and the girls just were left home to learn a little bit of sewing and a little drawing and whatnot, and maybe a little French, but that's about it. So Mary just really taught herself by reading. One of her friends' fathers taught her some science. So she and Fanny started this school. And the school was doing pretty well, thriving for about a year until Fanny got married and went over to Portugal to live and was pregnant. And Mary went over when the baby was due because she knew Fanny was consumptive and was just concerned about her. And unfortunately, Fanny died in childbirth, and mother and son both died. Mm. So the school failed. And so,
now, was this a school for girls?
This was a school for girls.
Okay.
Yes, a school for girls, mm-hmm. which again was fairly unusual. I mean, there were dame schools, as they called them. But this school was teaching a little bit more than the average school would teach girls. So it was quite unconventional. She came back from there and just utterly penniless. So she heard that there was an opening for a governess. She answered an ad for this very wealthy Anglo-Irish family named Kingsborough in County Cork in Ireland.
So that is based on fact.
Everything in my novel is based, in Midnight Fires, is based on fact. Okay. I mean, all the characters in it, I would say two-thirds of the characters in it were real people. So she took a packet boat in 1786 over to Cork, and then when she saw she was going to live in this castle, they lived in this Mitchelstown castle. Just to backtrack slightly, it was in 1761 that Robert King, who was 16 years old, married his third cousin, who was 15 years old, Caroline. And they were third cousins, yes, and she was a Fitzgerald from way back, and they had this common ancestor who was a white knight in the 13th century. They called him a white knight because he always wore white armor. And so the Fitzgeralds became sort of peers of the land, and eventually the kings intermarried with their family. So anyway, so she was there for 10 months. And finally was dismissed because a Lady Kingsborough, and they were always at odds anyway, because Mary wanted to teach her girls how to think. She wanted to teach them Shakespeare and how to think and some language. But Lady Kingsborough wanted them to learn how to embroider, to really use the needle.
Learning pianoforte was a big thing.
Pianoforte, yes, all of this. And Mary couldn't even play the piano herself. She had none of these skills. She had none of these marriageable skills. She was going to teach them how to think for themselves. So she was finally fired because Lady Wollstonecraft said that she was taking loyalty and love away from me. Because the girls seem to like her more than they did their mother.
What about the book is fiction then? You've based it all on real characters.
Yeah.
So the storyline itself, what's real and what's fiction within the storyline?
Okay, that's a good question. What is real, of course, is Mary herself.
Right.
And this was not easy to do because I had to follow. I never write an outline anyway, but I did have an outline of Mary's life. And so I had to, and I read umpteen books, etc., and all of her collected letters in which she writes to her sisters about that 10 months that she was there. So that was a big help to me. So a lot of little incidents that occurred there I could use, like the time Lady Kingsborough gave her a worn dress with the hem a little bit ripped and said, "Here, this is for you, dear." And you know, under the arms was perspiration. And Mary said, "No, thank you," which got Lady Kingsborough confused. A lot of things like that I could use. So I had to keep her in the place where she really was in real life. I couldn't have her out of there. So she was basically at Mitchelstown Castle, except for a short time when the family did go to Dublin, mm-hmm. where they had a big home there. So all of that was real. All of the Kingsboroughs were real. And I read whole life stories as much as I could find on Lord and Lady Kingsborough and George, the oldest boy. What was fictional in it is that I made up, the only family member I made up who was fictional was a half-brother, illegitimate, who I called James King. Mm-hmm. And he's actually based on somebody else, but he was not a real person. And he gets a peasant girl pregnant, a young girl named Fiona.
Right.
And she is fictional. So he is fictional, and he is stabbed at Samhain. This Samhain is this pagan festival, which is sort of similar to our Halloween. So he is stabbed, and nobody knows why he's stabbed. Perhaps it has something to do with this. And the girl's uncle, whose name is Leon, is one of the peasants and a defender, and he is accused of killing this James. So that is all, that part is all fictional. And this whole family, this whole peasant family named Donovan are all fictional.
Okay. And Nora?
And Nora is fictional. Nora is the housekeeper and she's fictional. The events are real anyway, in most cases. And then I fictionalized the mystery part of it is fictionalized. As she's coming over in the packet boat when she first arrives, she sees a sailor that she had been talking to, and he had given her a letter for somebody named Liam, who turned out to be that uncle, in Mitchelstown, because she'd been talking about going to Mitchelstown, and the sailor, who it seems from their conversation had been in the colonies before, and because they were pretty excited when the American Revolution, the defenders and other groups really got inspired by the American Revolution. If we could get rid of those hated British over here, they could do the same thing in Ireland. So the sailor is overboard. In fact, I may read a tiny bit of that.
Great, yeah.
In the very first chapter. And Mary has this letter just burning in her brain and has no idea how she's going to find this Liam, whoever he is, in Mitchelstown. But she did think she saw a flash of a knife as he went overboard, and so perhaps he was killed. So the sailor is the first death in the novel.
And that's a fictional event.
Okay. But it is based on real life, because when Mary came back from seeing Fanny Blood die, her good friend who was in Portugal, on the way back, she had to make this very long crossing over, it's almost 13 days apparently in those days to get from Portugal back to England. And there was quite a storm at sea, and her ship's captain, well, not a storm, but it was rough crossing. And so her ship's captain was just bent on getting back to England, but a couple of ships had gone down in the storm, and one was a French ship, and there were some French sailors who were stranded in their boats. And the captain was not going to do anything about it. He just had his eye on England. Besides, the English hated the French anyway. They've been at war for years and centuries. So Mary marched into his cabin and said, I'm just going to, if you don't turn this ship around right now and rescue them, I'm going to inform the authorities about your inhumanity to man and take you to court. And she got some of the other passengers behind her saying, yes, yes, turn around, turn around. And he did. He finally rescued those sailors. Oh. So that's another reason I thought she'd be a great sleuth, because she always had that sense of hating any kind of injustice.
Yes, yeah.
So that's what gave me the idea for this sailor going overboard, because she tries to get somebody to the captain to go and do something about it. I mean, nobody will, because they're almost there and they won't in Ireland, and they just want to keep on time and
that
kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, having mentioned the sailor, maybe now is a good time for you to read from Midnight Fires.
Oh, okay, sure. All right, I was just going to read like a page from the beginning and then skip over to what happened to him.
Okay.
All right. Okay. The crossing from Holyhead to Dublin had been relatively calm, but just as the Irish coast came into view, a contrary wind blew up. Wrapped in her black greatcoat, Mary Wollstonecraft clutched the railing and watched the sky go purple, the clouds turn gray. Her stomach churned, her breath quickened. Wind tossed the packet boat to and fro like a child's toy in a pond. I am that toy, Mary shouted into the wind. I am a vessel of fate. The words blew back to her like an echo from the wailing sea. Mary was on her way to Ireland to be a governess, a most humiliating occupation. She was still reeling from a catastrophic love affair. She was deeply in debt to a pack of hungry creditors. Her mother was dead. Her younger sisters had failed at the teaching post she procured for them. They were hammering at her gates for help. To appease them, she was about to be delivered into the hands of one of the most notorious families in Ireland, and all for the paltry annuity of £40. She thought of the pound of flesh exacted by Shakespeare's Shylock. She worried that the Anglo-Irish Lord and Lady Kingsborough would extort that pound from her. Oh, she did hope her employers would be kind. The final blow, her beautiful new blue hat, the gift of a dear friend, whipped off her head by wind. She lunged for it. She teetered on a boot heel, pitched forward. A calloused hand yanked her back on her feet. She glanced about, hoping to see the young clergyman who had engaged her in dialogue when she first boarded the vessel. But it was not Henry Gabelle. It was a blue-jacketed, claret-haired sailor who handed over the drenched hat. Powerful wind, eh, miss? Her feet more stable in the deck now, she thanked him and lifted her chin to show that Mary Wollstonecraft was not to be undone by a vagary of nature. In his solemn eyes, she saw an appreciation for her person. You're a brave one you are to be out here in the deck, he said in the thick brogue of the Irish peasant. But 'twill blow over soon, I've seen the like. We'll be in port and headed for home by the grace of God. He spoke the word home longingly, as though he had been away a long time, and she asked if he had. Her spirits rose to be conversing with such a sturdy, well-formed lad. Men of her own class, she had lately discovered, were not only untrustworthy, but downright boring. In the American colonies, he said, and then back over the seas again, and of late in England. And whose side did you favor? She demanded. His thick hair was pulled back in the long pigtail of the common sailor. Was the American Revolution fought as well by sea? She was not able to keep up with all the news or afford the papers that broadcast it. It was the rebels who had his sympathy and confided in a half-whisper, as though an English officer might overhear and string him up from the yardarm for treasonous remarks. An Irishman fight for the English. By Christ, I die first. And then I'm just going to skip a little bit. They have a conversation. The storm appeared. It had been something of a storm during the crossing. Mm-hmm. The storm appeared to subside as the packet sailed into the Bay of Dublin, but then the wind blew up again and kept the boat beating about the coast for a better part of an hour. Gusts of rain forced Mary back toward the ladder that led below decks. Grabbing at rope and rigging, she staggered about like the proverbial drunken sailor. She had almost reached the ladder when her sailor reappeared, thrusting something at her. A letter? He pressed it into her hand. Deliver it for me. I'm begging you, he pleaded, his face as white as his teeth, his cheeks blowing in and out. The ship lurched and threw her against him. He gripped her shoulders and helped her to grasp the ladder. She squinted down at the letter. For Liam. Liam who? Where does he live? Mary called to the fellow, who had already turned away. I'm only going to Mitchellstown, I said. Mitchellstown, she shouted, over the screech of sails, the howl of wind, the hallooing seamen. In tiny letters at the bottom, she saw the letter was to be delivered to a Liam in Mitchellstown, the reason perhaps for his pursuing the conversation. Wait, you must find someone else to deliver it. Holding onto her hat with one hand, the rigging with the other, she reeled about to find him. He was nowhere in sight. She was sorry now she'd told him her destination. If she could not find a Liam, so be it. She thrust the letter into the pocket of her greatcoat. Mercy, a woman cried, clapping a hand on her arm. Look! She pointed toward the bowsprit. Must have fell, eh, poor man? Mary glanced back to see a sailor plummeting into the water, flying. She watched, incredulous, too shocked to speak. Down he flew like a wounded gull, somersaulting into the water. An outcry rose up, folks shouting, peering into the sea. It was her sailor, she was sure of it, that blaze of blue eye, the streak of claret hair. The fellow did not come up at all. The sea had swallowed him whole. Ho! She shouted, racing along the deck. Help! Man overboard! Go after him! Someone, quick! Wind and surf drowned her words. Already the sailors were scurrying back to their duties. None would dare those churning waters. She yanked on the sleeve of a passing steward and poured her anguish into his ear. He looked at her blankly. I saw it, she said. He was there on the bowsprit. He fell. The fellow shrugged. Lose their balance, they fall, happy to float up on shore. Something had flashed at the sailor's neck as he fell, she was sure of it. A knife or a shaft of light on a button. For the wind had abated as her sailor had predicted. The sun was pushing through the shredding clouds. She demanded to see the captain, but was told it was impossible. Not now, the steward said. Not when we're coming into port. He waved her off like a buzzing fly.
Thank you for reading
that. So
that
did come out of her experience, and then I just used it in a different way.
Right.
But in this case, nobody went to the aid of the sailor.
But it's a pretty exciting opening. I'm curious how you found it to write in the style and language of the 18th century time period. How did you find that?
Yeah, what I did was to read, oh my gosh, umpteen novels, Fanny Burney, and there were so many wonderful novelists of that time. And that helped. And I'd read, Tom Jones, a lot of great novels of the period. So that helped me a little bit with and the language isn't all that different, except the idioms are different. Mm-hmm. But the problem that you really have once you begun to get a feel for the language, and also the words that are different. I mean, some words, for example, I had this wonderful editor who also had done a lot of research herself, and I did have Mary going into this Mitchellstown castle up in her room and hanging her coat in a closet, and my editor immediately said, no, you can't do that. A closet back in those days was not something to hang coats in. That was just a small study. It was a whole room. You know, it was a closet. So a lot of things like that.
So would it be a wardrobe?
It would be a wardrobe, okay. Yes. So that was part of the language. And I feel that, and talking with other writers for that century or any historical writers, that if you make the language just sound too stilted, it's just not going to feel right for the reader. I want the reader to be comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can throw in a few archaic words now and then, and just so you're really careful you don't have any anachronisms. So I tried to sort of go in between. And of course, for the Irish, I've done a lot of theater with, like, Riders to
right,
the Sea.
Right, you've got a nice brogue for reading when you do your readings.
But Riders to the Sea was one of my favorite plays when I first went to college, my freshman year, I guess we read Riders to the Sea. And I was thinking of that and just the language there. So, and reading, I also read a lot of Irish literature of the 18th century.
I would think reading her letters would have helped
and
find her
letters.
Her voice.
Yes,
too.
Finally, that's what I was going to say here. Finally, her letters. And her collected letters, I would recommend to anybody who's interested in Mary Wollstonecraft to read her collected, I mean, all when she was involved with the French Revolution, she was there during the worst days of the Great Terror. She had a wild and conventional life. She was falling madly in love, passionately in love when the heads were rolling off the guillotine and lost her own head, metaphorically speaking. But anyway, her letters helped a lot because that gave me a feel for her voice. And when I read all of her own works, because she wrote two novels as well as a lot of nonfiction. But her works, her other writing, including A Vindication of the Rights of Women, which she wrote in about 6 weeks, and was published page by page the way Dickens did. You know, you never had a chance to revise because they'd whip
it
off.
As soon as you write it.
Crazy. But it's, their language for her writing was more, I would say, academic, you know, like academic writing now, which is different from, say, journalistic writing,
right,
which is more accessible to the reader. And so her, that's the way her letters are. They're just totally accessible. And I can just, I can see her, I can almost hear her in those letters. And so I have taken some of the dialogue that I've used, I have taken out of her letters, like the time when Lady Kingsborough wants her to come down, I think it was on a Sunday morning or something, and speak to somebody who speaks some French, because Lady Kingsborough didn't speak any French. And Mary was, this is one a moment when she was off duty, so she just sent a message down by the maid, I'm sorry, but I can't come down, my French sticks in my throat. And that came right out of her letters. I mean, all those, these wonderful details in her letters. So I hope I've not, you know, you always have a worry that something's going to come through or somebody's going to say, no, wait a minute, a woman didn't think like that in the 18th century, and that was one of the harder things to do, to know how people thought. And to be able to get into Lady, I do, most of this is the point of view of Mary herself, but some of it's from the point of view of Lady Kingsborough. So I'm trying to see how she thought in those days. Why was she such a pill, I might say? Why is she so difficult? And I did know that she had a temper, and I did find out some things about her.
But, yeah, yeah.
So
I was just going to ask about, I was going to ask you about the researching of this book, but in introducing that idea, I wanted to read something from the book.
Yeah.
This takes place during a funeral, and it goes, the Keening women were mostly elderly, eyes brimming with tears as they lifted their wrinkled arms and voices in a high, thin rise, and then a waterfall of grief. They were professionals, according to Nora, hired, to Mary's astonishment, to enhance the melancholy mood. I thought, wow, it must be so much fun to be researching the book you're going to write and find something like that that you can use.
Yeah.
I don't know about professional mourners. Is that something that goes way back? I mean, it must go back at least to the 18th century.
Oh, yes, or go back before that. I'm sure it went way back. Yeah, I think that's when I was directing Writers to the Sea, when I was down in New York. And Writers to the Sea, of course, has in the very end, because this woman has lost all of her sons to the sea in that. And in the end, the mourners are coming in and they're all grieving, they're all keening. And some of them were just probably kinswomen, yes, but many of them were just elderly women who... maybe you wouldn't call them exactly professional mourners, but you know, if there's a death, even if they didn't know the person, they would still come and grieve, just to be sort of in empathy with
and
this
was there
death.
Any superstitious aspect to it? Was there a chasing away of bad spirits that had to do with the keening, or is that just
I think that might have been a part of it. Yeah,
yeah.
I think that might have been.
And then another piece I found really interesting was when, I think it was Caroline, was using a leather contraption to keep wrinkles from forming.
Oh, yes,
in her
yes.
sleep.
Yes, exactly.
What was that?
That was horrible. And this black sort of almost polish on her, shoe polish kind of stuff on her eyes. It was dreadful that kept getting into her eyes when she would speak. Yes, I found that. I also have read, of course, umpteen books on life in the 18th century and the cosmetics that women would use. And so that was something that I did find. And of course, how women would take, and I also found this in Mary's letters. Mary only had about 3 changes of clothing, of gowns. She had very few. She was very little interested in how she looked, at least at this period. It wasn't until later she fell in love with somebody that she was more interested in how she looked. But at that time, but she was horrified that Lady Kingsborough would spend up to 3 or 4 hours just dressing and getting her hair done to come down to the drawing room to receive her visitors. So I did study, I did read up on, you know, how women, what they were doing, what the process was during these 3 hours,
right,
getting themselves ready and,
yeah,
and so on. And they're almost, their headdress is almost like a, you know, a great beehive or... and I have one character in there I just have a lot of fun with, the agent's wife, who is always wearing something that's tipping over in her rage of some sort. But yeah, so I had to do a lot of research in that. It's an enormous amount of research, because I had all my other books before this had been contemporary.
Right. Did you enjoy writing this one?
I loved writing. I loved writing because I was just really had... As I had said in the beginning, when I first found out about Mary Wollstonecraft and who she was, I just immediately, she became just sort of an alter ego for me.
Yeah.
And I just, and I, a lot of things in my life were similar to her life. I mean, my father died when I was 12, and family was very impecunious, and I got stuck in away in the school and never had a room of my own, and so we had, and I... just a lot of things that were somewhat similar to her.
Really resonated.
Yeah, and so I had always just adored her and wept continuously when I discovered she was only 38 when she died, giving birth to Mary Shelley.
Oh.
Which, so she never even knew her daughter. She never even could read Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah. I know that this is a new publisher for you. Midnight Fires is published by Perseverance Press.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about the publishing process for this book?
Yeah. Well, I had done 5 mystery novels with St. Martin's Press, and that was my dairy farmer, Ruth Wilmarth, which I loved doing. And the last one of those, which is called Mad Cow Nightmare, all of her cows, beloved cows, were taken away to be euthanized. And so it sort of ended the series. I didn't know what I was going to do after that. I decided that I'd do, I would go back to doing something in the 18th century. I was working at the same time on a book, a young adult book, that was to take place here in the 18th century. So I had been studying the 18th century anyway, and reading Abigail Adams, about Abigail Adams, who loved Mary Wollstonecraft, by the way. Mm-hmm. When her Vindication came out, she was a disciple of her, basically. And so I decided then that I would just go into the 18th century, because I was really... It was a time of enlightenment. It was just a time, it was a period. I guess in the French Revolution I'd always been interested in anyway, having minored in French in college and majored in English. And so I'd written a long paper on the French Revolution, and I am researching that now for the third book in the series, will take place when Mary is in Paris. So I heard about... then I wrote had a period where I wrote a couple of children's mysteries instead, and then I heard about Perseverance Press in Publishers Weekly. I read an article about the editor, who I had heard from some other people that it's a medium, small to medium press, but very prestigious. I mean, they get reviews in Publishers Weekly and all the big mm-hmm. trade magazines. And I'd heard about this editor from another friend who had worked with her. My editor is Meredith Phillips, and she's an absolutely wonderful editor, a tough editor. Boy, she almost researched the book with me, and she's just constantly on everything. She kept me from making a fool out of myself with some of the things I said when I would make a mistake or add another anachronism or something like that. And we go, and I have constant access. I mean, we email each other all the time, and my publicist also, who's just delightful.
Yeah.
It's actually, they're an imprint of Daniel and Daniels, which is a book that just does some literary fiction and nonfiction. And Perseverance Press is the imprint of that. What she calls is literary. She calls it literary mysteries for the Golden Age.
Okay.
So I just just sent her a query, and she sounded interested in it. And
now, were you still working with an agent at that point, or had you
yes, and I still have my agent. But since this is not a big press, a huge press, where I'd get a lot more money the way I did with St. Martin's Press. Not that that was ever any huge amount. They will give me an advance, but I mean, it's not enough to interest my agent, who is a businesswoman.
Sure.
Basically, I just sent it off by myself to Meredith, and then she took it and when I first wrote it, I wrote it in present tense. And Meredith looked at it and thought, oh no, you know, that just, she never liked present tense because she thought it sounded kind of pretentious. Mm. And you're trying to be too literary or whatever. So I had to rewrite, before I got the contract, I had to rewrite the whole book in past tense. And then I was glad I did after that, because even originally I had written in first person. And then I thought, my word, how arrogant it is of me to try to write in Mary's voice. As if I am, because I'm trying to calm her, but I wanted more of a distance, so I did put it in third person, so I could keep it.
That was probably a valuable exercise in finding her voice.
So it took me many, many, many different, I can't think how many drafts of the book I had done of this with all these changes, until finally we got it in past tense, third person. And then it went more smoothly from there.
Right.
And then I had, of course, all the edits that would come back and forth and so forth. So Perseverance Press and they call it Perseverance because they also take people who have been with other, and they only actually take writers who have already been with larger presses.
Mm-hmm.
So that they've already been, I guess you might say, vetted in a sense.
Sure.
And she doesn't do a lot of books. She only does about 8 or 10 a year. So anyway, she took me, so I was lucky. And
so that sort of says that you're going to stay a subscriber of Publishers Weekly forever now, right?
Yeah.
Having discovered
I know.
This.
Oh, I did. I've subscribed to them anyway. Yeah. Yes, and they gave me a nice review. So I was very happy with
it. That's great.
Called it captivating, which was very nice. So I was very happy with that.
You mentioned a little while ago that you've done a lot of work in the theater. How has your work in the theater influenced your writing?
I think one thing is probably interesting, the way it influenced me in the way that I write. I'm thinking of like the Stanislavski method, for example, which is when, okay, you're in a play and you want to express the grief that somebody feels. Well, like I say, Writers to the Sea, you know, this mother feels and they're grieving. But it's hard for you you have to try to think, as the actress, you have to try to think of some experience, some time when you were grieving yourself, or even someone else was grieving that you were, had empathy for or whatever, so that the theater
can access that same.
Yeah, so you can transfer
emotion.
That emotion to your role, and so I think that the act of trying to become your character is something that the writer can do, and the writer, you try to become your character as you're writing it, and where I was taking a real life character. Someone who, you know, people knew was a celebrated person or cause de célèbre or whatever, I had to try to become her as much as I could. So that's one thing. Another thing that really has helped me a lot is that I always, when I write, and I've done this even before I was writing a historical novel, was to try to see the scene in front of me as if it's on a stage. So I'm doing a scene as if my characters are up there, and I'm trying to see how they react to other characters, how they handle their props, you know, what their expression is, what they smell like, what their eyes look like, you know, just generally what they do, all the shadings of voice and expression. So that really has helped me a lot, mm-hmm. in just seeing the scene and putting it in front of me. And in the stage, you're always trying to find what's the focus of this scene and what's the purpose. What is my as a character, what is my purpose? What am I trying to do in this scene? And I'm trying to do the same thing in my book. I'm trying, what is the focus of this scene and what am I saying in this scene? I can't have a scene that just sort of ends blah without any real raison d'etre, you know, that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
So I think that's what the theater has really done.
And have you ever written for the theater?
I have written some plays, and actually just 2 years ago you interviewed me about one of my kids' novel, and my son in Burlington, who has the Very Merry Theater up in Burlington, does umpteen plays, does many, many plays each year, and has in the summer. He has a summer camp, and for two weeks, first week they read the play and work it out and block it and everything. The second week they go around to different towns and put it on. So he asked me if I would take the Great Circus Train Robbery and turn it into a play, which I did for him. And we had a lot of fun. We did that last summer, and we had great time doing that. So, and then he had a grant for the quadricentennial. And the quadricentennial, he asked me if I would do a play for that. So I did a play, which was part of this play, a young adult novel that I was writing about these three girls walking up into Vermont in the 18th century, driving a cow. So I wrote that as a play, and we did put that down on the waterfront. Except it rained a lot last summer, so we had a lot of trouble when we were down by the waterfront.
Were you outdoors?
Yeah. Oh. Most of his theater that he carries around on a flatbed, that's an actual theater, is usually performed outdoors. But if it's raining on the audience, it isn't quite such a happy situation. But we had it indoors a couple of times also. So I've done some plays for him. I'm doing another one for him now. And I've done a couple for adults that I've just done, but not, you know, professionally or anything like that.
Okay. And now you've mentioned that you're working on a couple right now, but what else are you working on?
Well, I've also got a sequel to After Midnight Fires, which takes her through those wild and woolly 10 months. Then the next one is the draft of the next one, and I'm about to get all the edited stuff back from my editor this summer, and that one is called The Nightmare, and that takes place in London, and this takes place the year that Mary wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Woman.
So it's going to be a trilogy.
It's going to be a trilogy, probably. If I live long enough to write another one, I might have her in Scandinavia. She did go to Scandinavia.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time.
Yeah.
And
right.
I do always ask the same question for my last question. Now, I asked you this last time, too. My question for writers, my last question is always, what do you do when you get stuck in your writing?
Oh, yes, that's a good question, when you get stuck in your writing. Yeah, I mean, Mary went through this when her publisher, who's this wonderful publisher, who was sort of a father confessor to her, told her that he wanted her to, and she planned to do a sequel to Vindication of the Rights of Woman. She was going to take all the laws, like a man could own a woman's property, a man could put his wife in a madhouse if he wanted with impunity and all this kind of thing. She was going to write that, but because she was in love with Henry Fuseli, she couldn't seem to get down to writing it. She just couldn't do it. She was just in another world. So she was out of it. So if I get that way, since I've been writing these, I've had a very happy relationship here with my spouse, so I haven't had any writer's block in that way. But there are times. Well, I broke my arm. Okay, that's a problem. I broke my arm 2 months ago, and that's been really, really difficult partly because I'm trying to promote the book and also trying to start to write the third. Written a second, I'm trying to write or start a draft of the third one, which is set during the French Revolution. And it's been really hard to do, in part because I can only use my left hand, I broke my dominant hand, and in part because I just didn't have as much energy. And there are just other things that I had to do, just many, many other things that were in my life at the time. We'd also had some other accidents in our life. My son, garage door came down on his head. And my granddaughter was in an accident in which another girl was killed. It was,
oh my gosh.
All sorts of awful things. So things like that happen. And I think the only thing you can do is, I've usually been pretty good. I can usually block those things out and concentrate on a book. But recently, with all of these other accidents and things, I've had a harder time doing it. But I'm getting back into it now. I'm getting now so I can get back into it. So other than that, I've really never had much writer's block. What I normally would do is when I'd write a chapter, right, say in the morning, I'd try to almost finish the chapter. And then I'd leave it, I'd know what it was going to, since I don't outline ahead, I'd know what's going to happen in the end and just make myself a couple of notes. So when I come down to my computer the next morning, I can start right at that point and I know what's going to happen, and then that sort of swings me right into the next chapter that I didn't. So little tricks like that one can play on oneself. Yeah. So I don't know that I really have had any great writer's block. That.
And then you said a minute ago that Mary's editor said something to her. What was that you were going to say?
Yes, this is Mary's publisher. He was a bookseller. A bookseller and publisher were almost simultaneous terms at the time. Because a lot of booksellers, as he was, would also publish books. So, yes, he tried to keep her, and he adored her, and he just, you know, kept her. He was also a banker for her. He also kept her in money, giving her all these big advances. So he would tell her, Mary, you've got to do this. You've got to settle down and do this. The publisher, his name was Joseph Johnson, and Joseph is the one, she called him Little Joseph because he was quite short. And he was the one who said, Mary, you've got to get this finished. So her publisher really kept her at it, which publishers and editors do. He was her publisher and he was her editor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he kept saying to her, Mary, you know, why are you, she would say, look, we've got to go off and do something today because one of my sisters is coming and I want you to meet her. And Mary, why are we doing this when you should be back in your room writing the next section? Now tell me how many pages. Let's look at these pages together. But then she hadn't done it.
But it sounds like it's helpful to have a sort of writing companion who's egging you on, a little cheerleader.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, and that's exactly what he did. Oh, he was an amazing man, this Joseph Johnson.
Yeah.
I mean, they had this whole little group of he published Wordsworth, he published Coleridge, William Blake. William Blake illustrated one of Mary's books for children called Original Stories, in which she was a governess with children. She used that experience. He published all kinds of well-known people. William Payne, who was the revolutionary. So he really could keep her going.
Yeah, that's great.
And my editor, I'm always getting... My editor's always sending me little emails. Well, wouldn't it be a good idea to try... Oh, I just had an email from somebody who's looking for... a little... From the Publishers Weekly, actually. This is fairly recent, who wants... to write an article about historical writing historical fiction, has some questions. Would you mind answering those questions for him? I think it would help the promotion of our book. So I said, okay, yeah. But she's always goading me on.
Yeah.
Or I can't understand this. Or could you choose? In fact, I was just I have a fan page called Becoming Mary Wollstonecraft on Facebook, and I was just writing the other day on. Something that he said to her, he actually said to her, and was when one of the letters... Oh, she was sending him something she had written, and she said, please don't, I think this is rather good. I'm quite pleased with this bit of writing I did. And please don't tell me that you don't understand what I'm saying. That I think it's perfectly clear. And you can just hear him probably in a note saying, what do you mean? What do you mean?
So
I was just amused by that. So I did put it on Facebook.
Well, Nancy, it was really nice to talk to you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's really been delightful.
That, once again, was a conversation with Nancy Means Wright. To see more about her new book, Midnight Fires, you can visit her website at nancymeanswrite.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my guest, Nancy Means Wright, whose work in the theater has helped her as a fiction writer. She said during our interview, "When I write, I try to see the scene in front of me as if it's on a stage, as if my characters are up there." She tries to see how her characters react to each other, how they handle their props, how they look, and what they do. She tries to experience all of the shadings, as she put it, of their voices and expressions. On the stage, Nancy says, you are always trying to find the focus and purpose of a scene. So, this week, try to do the same in your work. If you're writing a scene, try to understand its focus and purpose. If you're writing about a character who's going through an emotional experience, you can also try the system of accessing that emotion by recalling some experience of your own. This system of acting, developed by Konstantin Stanislavski, may help you empathize with your character's situation as you try to write about it. As Nancy said during our interview, the act of trying to become your character is something that a writer can do. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. We'll bring you more great music. And I think Cheryl Willoughby will be here at 3 o'clock with The World of Music. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.